From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. It's official, 2025 is over. And if you've kept your eye on the news, you know it was a packed year. There was President Trump's second inauguration in January and the start of Nevada's 83rd legislative session in the spring. We saw a Southern Nevada team go to the Little League World Series and the start of construction on a big league stadium on the Strip. While immigration-related arrests are up, the number of visitors flying into Harry Reid International Airport is down. All of it amounted to a lot of news to take in. So we thought we'd spend today's show revisiting some of our favorite stories and conversations from 2025. One of them focused on Nevada and the country's growing number of missing and murdered indigenous people. The Bureau of Indian Affairs estimates there are roughly 4,200 MMIP cases that have gone unsolved. The crisis has gained mainstream attention in recent years, largely thanks to the efforts of Native communities themselves. But the people in those communities say there's still much that needs to be done to help them protect and find their loved ones. KNPR's Jimmy Romo spent months talking to people around the state about those cases. Here's that story.
Rain Henry left her home and child on the Moapabana Paiute Reservation outside Las Vegas on April 12th of this year. She was on her way to attend a concert at the Fremont Street Experience, an estimated one-hour drive. But after she left, no one heard from her. David Black Guy is a tribal liaison for the state of Nevada's Department of Public Safety. He consults with law enforcement agencies that have missing and murdered Indigenous persons, or MMIP, cases.
That last case, the Moapa case, once I heard about it, once we got the information, once we put it up on the website, I don't think there was an hour of the day where it didn't cross my mind.
After Black Guy added Henry's case to the state's MMIP website, social media carried her missing persons alert out of Southern Nevada to national social media sites. Due to an agreement between the Moapa Band of Paiutes and local municipalities, multiple law enforcement agencies were already on the lookout for any sign of Rain Henry in Las Vegas and on the reservation. Off Interstate 15, near the reservation, Nevada State Police located a deceased woman's body inside a wrecked vehicle. Christopher Pascal is the Moapa Band of Paiutes tribal administrator and former chief of tribal police. In early May, Pascal gave an update on the case.
Unfortunately, it was discovered that Rain Henry was involved in a traffic collision on Interstate 15 within the borders and boundaries of the reservation. It took about 5 days after the accident occurred to get final confirmation. There's so many different leads, so many different tips and community members that truly care, and they wanted the best. They were hoping for the best. And that's the hard part right now for this community. But unfortunately, the facts are is that she was involved in that accident.
In the end, Henry was only reported missing for less than 2 weeks. Her mother learned her fate less than a month after she disappeared. Much sooner than most loved ones of MMIP victims. But awareness is growing. In February of 2022, Pyramid Lake Paiute Tribe member Anna Marie Scott was identified as the driver of a burning vehicle on Interstate 580 between Reno and Carson City. The coroner found signs of an execution shot that likely took her life before the vehicle was set on fire. Weeks later, a young white woman, Naomi Irion, was reported to have been kidnapped in Fernley, Nevada. After the news broke, resources that could have potentially solved Scott's case shifted to Irion's case, along with most social media attention. Contrast that with Rain Henry's disappearance this year, where cross-agency cooperation and social media attention closed Henry's case within a month's time. Meanwhile, Scott's case remains unsolved. Police killed the lead suspect in an unrelated confrontation. He died with any information that might have helped solve the case. Scott was one of the first MMIP cases that David Black Guy added to the state's MMIP website. Most of them remain there with no new developments.
You know, somebody out there knows what happened in these cases, and we'll get the answer.
The MMIP crisis is a national one. The Bureau of Indian Affairs, or BIA, estimates that there are about 4,200 cases nationwide. Experts believe the actual number is much higher. Constance Athayedi is the Pyramid Lake Paiute Tribe Victim Services Program Director. Athayedi traces the violence Indigenous people experience today to the eradication of tribes during colonization.
Most of us can agree that when there's an implementation of a systemic methodology to destroy a culture, part of that is to destroy the families, to destroy the framework, and to dehumanize the people of that culture.
The methodology that Thaidi is referring to dates back to the early 1800s. U.S. colonizers created laws to justify a century of warfare and fraudulent land acquisitions, facilitating Western expansion. They ripped the remaining families apart through the boarding school program.
We can go again through the history of it as far as removing people from whole tracts of land to now it becomes a smaller and smaller circumference of impact as far as now we're going to actual homes, removing children and putting them in a boarding school. If you're informed, you know that those children were now finding their bodies. And so they were the missing and the murdered because many times they did not die of natural causes. And they certainly would have had a different impact had they been allowed to stay within their home.
Assembly Bill number 369, introduced by Assemblymember Backus, revises provisions governing certain orders for protection against domestic violence.
Challenges in solving MMIP cases range from a lack of funding to a lack of data collection. Another issue is overlapping jurisdictions. Since tribes are sovereign nations, local law enforcement agencies don't have implied jurisdiction for any tribal affairs. To help solve this problem, Assemblywoman Shea Backus pushed a bill, drafted with the help of victim advocates, through the 2025 Nevada legislative session, and Governor Joe Lombardo signed it into law. The law allows any officer to protect anyone with a court-issued domestic violence protection order. It's meant to address those who violate court orders and then defend themselves by saying they were not aware of the orders.
It would allow the officer to have that conversation right there with the potential abuser and say, hey, you know, this is a tribal court order. Take a look at it. I'm now giving it to you and serve it at that point.
In the 2023 legislative session, Backus got another big law passed. It allows non-tribal agencies to accept missing persons cases of tribal members through the Department of Public Safety. This allows the department to build a statewide database.
But at the end of the day, it came down to our state police who really stepped up and said, you know what, Shay, we'll go ahead, we'll take the report. They figured a way how to put it into the federal database because a lot of our local jurisdictions didn't feel comfortable with it.
The law also added a tribal liaison position to the Department of Public Safety to help consult on state MMIP cases, the position David Blackeye currently holds. But despite the progress made through the legislature, challenges still exist. There are discrepancies between sovereign nations and local municipalities' case tracking. That means currently there is no accurate centralized database at the federal or state level for Indigenous persons that are missing or murdered. In 2021, the BIA added a missing and murdered unit to address cases nationwide. But Blackeye said every state is struggling with the issue. In addition, Assemblywoman Shea Backus says the closure of the BIA's Elko office will likely lead to slower response times for Northern Nevada tribes. And response time is a critical factor to solving cases, according to Blackeye.
Culturally, we all know that the first 48 hours is important because that show the first 48, right? But that really is key. And I think that having delayed response times to criminal investigations is a major factor here. And the rural nature of some of the community is a factor. If you know that you're going to have a response time to an investigation of 24 hours, I mean, that's a tough one.
In Nevada, days may pass before an FBI or BIA agent arrives to begin investigating. On May 5th, one day after Rain Henry was identified by her mother, College of Southern Nevada students in Las Vegas met inside the student union. It was a rainy National MMIP Awareness Day on campus. Huddled around a table, the students used markers to draw red handprints on small pieces of paper. Angel Martinez, Native Heritage Alliance president, turned the drawings into buttons.
I love buttons. I think they're fun and they're easy to make and, you know, it does send a message. I've had more than one people ask about my buttons and what does that mean? Did you make it? And, you know, now I can say yes. I actually made this one.
People participate in National MMIP Awareness Day by wearing red or a red handprint. Tribal dancers and advocates sometimes put a red handprint on their face to represent the decades-long struggle with higher-than-normal rates of violence against American natives in the U.S. Martinez has a personal connection to the symbol.
And they have meaning to me because I know what this story is. It is my story. You know, it's my aunt's story. It's my grandmother's story. It's all their stories. And I'm still here, you know, and I want other people to be more observant of people like me, who look like me, and take notice when we don't show up somewhere.
Pyramid Lake's Constance Athaiti encourages people to remember MMIP every day, beyond the one day designated for awareness.
We need to remember that history happened. We're here because of the people that came before us, and it's our duty to be able to provide a time and place that history does not get repeated. So if we're there to be able to be a safe person or a safe place, or to be able to speak out for those who don't have voices, then that's our responsibility.
To report an MMIP case, contact your local law enforcement agencies. If you have any information on Anna Marie Scott, call the state's hotline at 844-733-7248. If you have any information about a case somewhere in the U.S., call the BIA's Missing and Murdered Unit at 883-560-2065. Jimmy Remo, KNPR News.
One story we've kept our eye on this year dealt with traffic safety, specifically the increasing number of children being struck by vehicles as they travel to and from school. So far this year, more than 200 kids have been hit in Clark County alone. In October, two children died. Clark County and local municipalities have significantly stepped up efforts to increase safety. In November, state lawmakers passed a law strengthening penalties on traffic violations in active school zones. And yet, despite all this, the accident rate continues to increase. KNPR's Yvette Fernandez went to a high school during what law enforcement called a saturation detail when several city police departments joined forces to augment school police.
While Tanya and Robert Watts wait outside Rancho High School to pick up their kids, they see what they call problem behavior every day.
The kids are not walking on the crosswalk like they should. They're walking in between the cars. And the cars are just trying to fly through while the buses, they're trying to get the buses out. And sometimes they just jump right in front of the cars.
Because right now it's just a chaos. They're just going through buses. They're not using the crosswalk. They're just going out in traffic without even stopping. Just like right now behind me.
You get cars that are doing U-turns when they shouldn't be doing a U-turn. You'll catch them flipping around and almost hitting a kid that did actually go in the crosswalk.
Examples like this are why the Southern Nevada cities of Henderson, Las Vegas, and North Las Vegas, as well as Clark County, are taking action. This school year, they allocated additional funding to hire a crossing guard company to place more guards at more elementary schools. It's around 2:30 p.m. on a drizzly September day outside Rancho High School, where I met the Watts parents. Students burst en masse from the building, dispersing in every direction. Cars are lined up along the street, waiting to pick up the students. Buses fill the parking lot. Everyone seems to be racing to get where they're going. Amid the chaos, the crossing guards themselves are too busy to stop what they're doing. But Lieutenant Michael Campbell with the Clark County School District's Traffic Division has a few minutes to talk. Campbell tells me the number of kids being struck by cars has increased this year.
We're at 54 this year.
54 kids have been struck at school?
Yeah, so almost double. And then this time 2 years ago is at about 35, so this is our highest year ever.
He says the additional crossing guards seem to have helped at elementary schools, but the accident rate has actually increased at high schools. Since our interview, Lieutenant Campbell says the number of students being hit in school zones has increased to 94, and there have been two fatalities this month. Campbell says autos aren't always to blame. Sometimes it's the kids.
A lot of the times the kids are just walking out or darting out into the street on their bikes. And, you know, about half of them are, of our crashes are due to kids on these e-bikes now, on the e-scooters.
Those I talked to blame the problem on everyone being in their own world, focused on their phones and not paying attention to what's going on around them. Bus driver Alejandro Navarro says he often encounters drivers who simply ignore the stop arm on his school bus.
Those lights come out, and some people just pass right at it, and they don't even pay attention to the bus. So people just be looking at their phones, and they don't pay attention to what's going on the street.
Navarro and his colleague Alejandro Caballero both drive buses for special needs students and say they take their jobs seriously.
There is a lot of responsibility what I got on board. If they're not my child, so anything what's going on to this child, it's on me. So I'm very, very careful what I'm doing on my job.
This fall, the school district formed a new working group consisting of law enforcement, school teachers and administrators, city and county officials, and parents. It's supposed to address the issues complicating school traffic safety.
For instance, this school that we're standing on right now is North Las Vegas that you're standing. Across the street is the city of Las Vegas. So if a crosswalk needs help, on this side of the street where it's not connecting safely to the other side of the street, now it's going to take at least two cities to fix it. And some of those schools are surrounded by four different, it could be the city of Las Vegas on one side, North Las Vegas, and the county, unincorporated Clark County on another side, plus the school district needing to be involved. So those discussions are now happening.
Another problem, the logistics of policing the country's fifth largest school district. It's an equation that can't be solved by additional policing alone, says Lieutenant Campbell.
There's just so many schools, and that's 300,000 students. And busing alone is something that's just huge because it's 1,500 bus routes every day with 36,000 different bus stops. So when somebody's like, why can't the school police get out here to these bus stops? But again, there's like 30 patrol officers. And then the six guys on bikes, and it's like, yeah, we try to follow a bus around here or there, but 36,000 bus stops is a lot.
On this one day, Lieutenant Campbell says 16 officers who were policing more than 20 schools wrote over 100 citations. Parents Tanya and Robert Watts support more punitive actions, such as tickets for parents and students who break traffic laws.
These kids got it so easy. And their parents don't want to be accountable. And they don't want to, they want to blame everything on the staff or the school. It's easy, see? Running right in the street. Now, if there was a car coming, hit a brake, the parents would want to blame Rancho High School.
There should be a staff there making sure they're using that crosswalk.
Ultimately, parents, bus drivers, and law enforcement say it's up to everyone to be more aware and more responsible.
Parents need to be the ones accountability and hold their kids responsible too, not just the school district.
If we could be patient, if we could be kind to each other, if we could look out for each other, if we could treat each other like we're each other's family members, like each kid is your own child, each crossing guard is like, you know, they're somebody's grandmother, grandfather, aunt, uncle. All these people matter. They're lives. They're not obstacles. They shouldn't be treated like obstacles. I know that it's chaotic, but if everybody could be a little more patient, that's how we could get better.
The new working group is expected to meet later this fall to continue finding ways to improve safety around schools. Yvette Fernandez, KNPR News.
. 2026 is an election year, and there's no doubt that the rising costs of housing will be a top issue across the country. But compared to other states, Nevada faces unique challenges when it comes to building new houses. That's because when the state wrote its constitution in 1864, it specifically relinquished to the federal government any right to land that settlers hadn't already claimed. It probably sounded like a great idea at the time. The vast tracts of federally owned land provided room for livestock grazing, mineral exploration, and extraction, as well as recreation. Today, however, many people argue that federal government's ownership of that land hinders development, particularly the development of affordable housing. So in collaboration with our sister station, KUNR, I took a look at the issue. It was part of their reporting series, Does Home Mean Nevada? Here's that story. Nestled between Reno to the west and the Virginia Range to the east, Sparks is home to more than 100,000 people. It traditionally served as a bedroom community for Reno. Nowadays, more and more people who work at the nearby Tahoe-Reno Industrial Center call it home. And that's causing some growing pains. Just ask Sparks Mayor Ed Lawson.
It looks like in about 10 years, we will not be able to build another house without going vertical.
Sparks, like many communities in Nevada, is facing a boundary issue. According to a 2021 study by the Economic Development Authority of Western Nevada, communities across Northern Nevada could start running out of parcels for residential development within the next few years, an issue that has caught the attention of one of the country's highest policymakers. Here's President Trump speaking to a group in Las Vegas while on the campaign trail last year.
We have so much land and we want to put it to use. So we're going to have land released, and on that land, we're going to build housing. We're going to have housing built, and it'll be great for Nevada and it'll be great for other areas.
Since taking office, his administration has initiated an assessment of all federal land within 10 miles of communities with more than 5,000 people to determine which land would be best suited for housing. However, it still requires a literal act of Congress to sell the land outright. And there are still questions about whether Western communities actually need the land at all.
There are really very few places in the West where national public land makes sense to build housing.
That's Aaron Weiss, Deputy Director of the Center for Western Priorities, a nonpartisan conservation advocacy organization based in Colorado. His group is among those that have been skeptical of recent pushes to open federal land over concerns about sprawl.
The things you need for affordable housing, you need to be close to an existing city. You need to be near the infrastructure, the roads, the sewers, the internet lines, the water in particular in the West, in order to do that in a way that's affordable.
Still, Weiss admits that some areas of Nevada likely do need a land deal similar to one passed in 1998 by the late Senator Harry Reid. Known as the Southern Nevada Public Lands Management Act, or SNPLMA, the law is considered by many to be landmark legislation. It opened thousands of acres of land for development and conservation and sent money from land sales to local communities.
Most successful bill in the history of the nation, public lands bill, is here in Nevada.
That's Representative Mark Amadei, Nevada's sole Republican in Congress. He's the sponsor of the Northern Nevada Economic Development and Conservation Act, which aims to replicate SNPLMA's success in rural areas of the state. It's also one of three public land bills currently before Congress. The others would sell off land around the Truckee Meadows in Clark County. However, critics argue that those bills simply aren't needed. A report released late last year by the Regional Transportation Commission of Southern Nevada found that there are more than 82,000 acres of vacant and underutilized land in the Las Vegas metro area available for infill development. That's an amount of land larger than the city of Henderson, the state's second most populous city. Olivia Tanager is the executive director of the Toyabe chapter of the Sierra Club. She says municipalities already have tools at their disposal to open up more land for development.
There are a number of parcels that need to be considered for rezoning and what folks refer to as upzoning. So meaning that you can build multifamily housing on tracts of land, because a lot of the land in Southern Nevada and in Northern Nevada is zoned for single family housing. And so that is a problem and is an inhibitor to developing in an affordable way.
But for politicians like Amadei, public land bills are the only way communities in the state can continue to develop.
If you want your communities to have the ability to evolve, you got to pass a public lands bill to remove portions out of the federal estate and into the ability of counties and city councils to do their planning and zoning on how they want their community to grow up.
Congressional hearings on both the Southern Nevada Economic Development Act and the Northern Nevada Economic Development and Conservation Act were slated for this month. Both were canceled due to the current federal government shutdown. Paul Boger, KNPR News. Sports is big business in Nevada. Take the Canelo Alvarez and Terrence Crawford fight at Allegiant Stadium in September. That match raked in a reported $47 million in ticket sales alone. Of course, boxing has a long history in Nevada. The state was the first in the U.S. to legalize professional prize fighting around the turn of the 20th century. And since then, Nevada has hosted some of the biggest bouts in the sport's history. Now Las Vegas is home to not one, not two, but three professional sports teams. So some worry that Nevada will lose its place at the heart of professional boxing. KNPR's Ann Davis had this report.
A boxer is pouring sweat as he throws 1-2 combos at his trainer. It's a common sight at Fight Capital Gym. Today, half a dozen college-age men and women are gearing up, stretching, and waiting for their turn to hop in the ring. They're with UNLV's boxing club, and they're warming up for their first training session of the fall 2025 semester.
So, I mean, it originally started as a hobby. It was something to get me in shape. I've lost probably 70 pounds doing this already.
That's Wyatt English. He's one of the members of the club. Even though he won the Super Heavyweight National Championship at this year's U.S. Intercollegiate Boxing Association tournament, he's still considered an amateur. At one point in Nevada's history, amateur boxing was popular. Nowadays, not so much. With the athletic infusion Las Vegas has experienced in the last decade, it's made experts wonder, what's next for boxing in the fight capital of the world?
There's a higher return in other sports right now, and that's largely because of the television exposure that, you know, pays the universities to be able to pay the athletes.
That's Bruce Trampler. He's an international boxing Hall of Fame promoter who moved to Nevada in the mid-1980s to work with Vegas-based Top Rank. He says that Vegas is still a major venue for pay-per-view and large title fights like the Canelo Alvarez v. Terrence Crawford bout in September. But he cautions that this might not always be the case, especially considering the neglect shown to amateur fights.
There's so many things you can do in Vegas now. For the amateurs specifically, you'd usually be relying on locals, and the locals have more to do.
Now, at least for the pros, Trampler says there's a lot of international rather than homegrown interest.
Most of the big name fighters are in Europe right now, England, the Middle East.
That's true for funding, too. Since 2019, boxing has seen an influx of Saudi Arabian money under the banner of Turkey Alashik's Riyadh season, which was a sponsor of Alvarez versus Crawford. Some trainers, like Mayweather Boxing and Fitness's Leonard Ellerby, see this cash infusion as a positive development for boxers choosing to fight in Vegas. That's especially since pay-per-view piracy is becoming a growing problem for all of combat sports. Here's Ellerby.
It's kind of hard to grow the sport, you know, from the fighter's perspective, because that's how they take care of their families, you know, the elite athletes. And that's when you have a Turkey Alashik who stepped in and he's been able to pay the fighters so they don't have to not make the big fights.
Trampler is more skeptical. Despite the cash infusion, he's of the opinion that many have lost interest. He says it's not like the old days.
When I moved to Vegas, we had boxing writers, you know, beat writers for each sport. And they would write two advanced stories the week of the fight, three stories. They'd cover the weigh-in, they'd cover the fight, they'd have a post-fight story.
Trampler doesn't see that anymore. Yet, experts are cautious to not discount boxing's future in Las Vegas. Rather, it's simply changing as promoters attempt to find the correct fit for a city with so many sports options. And while the city and the sport attempt to bolster the amateur ranks, Vegas's amateur fighters themselves, like Wyatt English, are seeing individual successes.
As long as I keep winning, I'll definitely keep competing with that.
Back at the UNLV Boxing Club practice, head coach Jason Crocco beams as he talks about his students.
You're part of a legacy. Like, you don't have to be the Mike Tyson or Floyd Mayweather. You can be like that first-time fighter. You're still part of history and part of a community.
Perhaps boxing really can remain a contender in the state that was instrumental in bringing the sport into the mainstream. Ann Davis, KNPR News.
Me many of us value our alone time, those few moments a day when we can unwind and just be ourselves. Now imagine if that time alone went on and on and on for what felt like forever. Now imagine you're spending that time in a box, no larger than a parking space. There are no windows, no clocks, no way to tell time or keep yourself preoccupied. It's just you and your thoughts. What you've imagined is essentially solitary confinement, an incredibly common practice in the American prison system, where humans can go 22 to 24 hours a day with little to no human contact. So what impact does that practice have on prisoners, and what does it say about the country's incarceration system as a whole? To talk about that, I reached out to Hannah Truby. She's the managing editor of the Sierra Nevada Ally, which published a three-part series looking at the use of solitary confinement in Nevada and the rest of the country. Here's our conversation from September. Hannah, thank you for chatting with me.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Talk to me about Frank DePalma. Who is he?
Yeah, so I first met Frank at a book reading here in Reno a couple of months prior, but he was a man who was incarcerated at Ely State Prison, 22 years in solitary confinement there at Ely, and I think 46 years in total within different Nevada state institutions. But he, since his release in 2018, he's become kind of an advocate for prison reform, and he's written a book about his experience, which is how I first met him. So yeah, as soon as I heard his story, I just kind of wanted to follow along more closely.
When we talk about solitary confinement, what are we talking about?
So it's, I guess it ranges, there's no agreed upon definition for solitary confinement. It can be anywhere from 22 to 24 hours a day. And it's usually the cell the size of a parking space is how I've been kind of explained to about it. It's usually 4 by 6 feet. It's usually windowless. And usually they get almost no human contact, very little meaningful human contact. Sometimes they get like an hour in the yard, or you know, they can receive visitors from time to time, but usually it's no human contact as well.
In De Palma's case, he was put in solitary confinement for his own protection. Is that a common practice?
Solitary confinement can be used for a number of reasons. It can be used for certain infractions, I guess, to keep certain people of the prison population safe. So in Frank's case, he was the victim of kind of a gang-related infraction. And so for his safety, as well as the safety of the prisoners, the, you know, Department of Corrections staff said, we got to put this guy in solitary. And it is very common. It can be used for any length of time. You know, there's people I've heard about in my research that spend decades like Frank did.
Currently, do we know how many people are in solitary confinement within the Nevada Department of Corrections?
Okay, yes. Yeah. So in Nevada, 10% of the prison population is in solitary, which is about 1,059 people, and the total custodial population is 10,400, give or take.
Is that a high number?
Yes. Nevada has, are like, for in terms of, you know, population or percentage of population, it is a high number.
Why is that? What's the reason for that high number?
Yeah, great question. I think kind of just what I've taken from speaking with experts, it seems like there's a lot of a big lack of oversight within institutions like Ely State Prison or, you know, High Desert. I believe a couple of years ago, they passed Senate Bill 307, and that bill was meant to kind of limit solitary confinement to more extreme circumstances and also limit it to up to 15 days at a time. However, they have no idea how that's even being enforced or monitored. And so I think I haven't looked at other states, but Nevada specifically, there's a lot of questions and gray areas to how that's exactly being monitored and enforced, especially with that high number.
When did solitary confinement become this kind of de facto tool to punish incarcerated people or even protect them?
Yeah, I guess it kind of became a routine method with the rise of supermax prisons in the 80s and 90s, you know, with the war on crimes, more supermax prisons were being created. And the difference between regular prisons and more supermax prisons are their tools of isolation that they use. And so we saw a big increase in solitary confinement after not seeing it for a long time in the States around the 80s and 90s, and then more so into the 2000s. What is distinct is just how extensive we use it here in the United States. So like I said, we can use it for anywhere from days to weeks to months to decades. But in other countries, they usually draw the line at no more than several days at a time. Because like in places like, you know, Scandinavian countries like Norway and Sweden, they have very well documented the effects of prolonged isolation and their effects on, you know, when they return to the general population or even just to the society, the recidivism rates are worse off. They experience a harder time reintegrating into normal society. And so I think that they've kind of, they have a much more stricter, I guess, stricter line than we do.
Let's get back to Frank De Palma. During his time in solitary, he told you that he largely became a ghost. What did he mean by that?
Yeah, so he, gosh, I mean, this part was just the part that I think really hits everyone so hard, is just hearing Frank talk about how he just kind of slowly lost himself for 22 years. I mean, if you think about it, it's complete isolation, total silence, no human contact. And in the, you know, early years, he would kind of turn inward and he would create these whole internal worlds, so he could kind of get a sense of human connection with that he wasn't getting in real life. So he would have, you know, he met a woman in a supermarket and they got married, he had children, he was a father, all these things that he started kind of slowly building up in his mind to kind of, I guess, satiate that need for human connection. But then as time went on, even that became unbearable for him. He said that, like, eventually reality would come crashing in and he just completely lost himself. He says the last 6 years of solitary, he has no memory of. He said he just became a hand reaching for his food tray every day. He said his father died in that time and he was notified, but he does not remember being notified. People came to visit him. He doesn't remember that either. I just think it completely chips away at your entire sense of self.
Is that experience common for people in solitary confinement?
It is, yeah. So, I mean, I haven't spoken with anyone who has experienced solitary as long as Frank had, but even within a matter of days, you see profound effects in terms of, you know, kind of losing your grip on, I mean, you don't have sunlight, you don't have a clock, you don't have the normal trackers of time. And so even within a matter of days, you become completely, I don't know, I guess you just become completely, you have nothing to depend on. And so we see the effects of, like, the physiological effects of solitary confinement, even after a matter of days. People become more paranoid, their anxiety increases, all of these things. And then obviously it just becomes compounded the longer you're in there.
Have you reached out to NDOC in all of this? What have they had to say about their use of solitary confinement?
I have, yeah, reached out to them many times over the weeks of my reporting on this, and I never heard back. I never spoke directly with them. I reached out to them, I think, 3 or 4 times for comment, but I never heard back.
Reading your reporting about Frank, it seems like he's at least doing better. He's out. He's become an advocate for those who've faced solitary confinement. He helped present testimony on SB 307, a bill that would look to limit the use of solitary confinement. What is his takeaway from his experience?
I was talking to him, actually, about the passage of Senate Bill 307, and he says, you know, everyone asks me if I'm happy about this, and of course I am, but he's really skeptical, just because while the passage of the bill, you know, was a major step in the right direction, there's still more work to be done. As advocates of prison reform well know, advocates and legislators will need to monitor the law's implementation, and that's just unclear exactly as to how that's being done, but he is doing a lot better. It's just really remarkable that he is where he is, you know, not back in prison or in, you know, with failing health or in a mental institution, because the odds were really stacked against him. People who've been in solitary are much more likely to reoffend, I think by 67%, than people who haven't experienced solitary. And so he's really, yeah, he's doing the damn thing and he's doing it well. So yeah, he wrote a book about his experience, like I said. And since then, I think conversation has been sparked more so since the bill's passage, as well as since he's been released. So things are looking up, at least.
Hannah Truby, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Las Vegas horror fans know J.T. Molnar as the creative director of the long-running Freakling Brothers horror show Halloween Haunts. International horror fans now know Molnar as the creative force behind the 2024 indie breakout film Strange Darling. And now even more fans have discovered him as the adapter of Stephen King's classic story The Long Walk, which was released in movie theaters in September. In its first weekend, the critically acclaimed film made $11.5 million, solidifying Molnar's status as the most successful filmmaker to come out of Las Vegas. KNPR's Mike Privat spoke to Molnar after The Long Walk's release.
Hi, JT. Welcome to State of Nevada.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, thanks for being here. So, how did your journey with The Long Walk begin?
I just finished directing and writing a movie called Strange Darling, and I was in post-production on it, and it was a really arduous process shooting the movie, and I was incredibly drained in a way where I just thought I couldn't direct something else right away, but I still wanted to work. And I remember Roy Lee, my producer, saying, what do you want to do next? And I was like, well, what I think I'd really like to do right now is just write something for somebody else so I can just spend a few months in my office at the keyboard and in the quiet. And he said, I know you love Stephen King. How would you like to write The Long Walk? And I said, I would love to write it.
What did you think The Long Walk was ultimately about? And how did you want your script to reflect that?
There's so many things it's saying and so many observations it's making about the human condition, which is mind-blowing because Stephen King wrote it at 19. And I was attracted to all those observations. One of the things I'll say I recognized in the book was this sort of, I mean, there's the obvious Vietnam metaphor, but for me, there was this sort of Scrooge story embedded in it. It had something to say about the rat race and the goals we have in life and gathering all these things, getting all these riches. Once you get to the end, nothing matters but the relationships you had. I also love the fact that he was commenting on relationships and being in the moment. And it's not always about the end. Stephen King was saying a lot about that in the book, and it was way ahead of itself. And then, you know, obviously there's very strong commentary on authoritarianism. You know, I think that's something that anybody can relate to. Slipping into that sort of cycle, and the cycle of violence as well is another thing that there was an amalgamation of things that were being sort of observed and talked about over the course of this walk.
Now, this is a fairly loyal adaptation of the novella, but you do take some creative license with some parts of the movie. You mentioned, you know, about dialogue earlier. You especially take some license, and I will not spoil it, the ending. And I'm wondering, how empowered did you feel in making changes to this much beloved source material?
I was cautiously optimistic because I'd seen an interview with Stephen King where he talked about Frank Darabont's The Mist.
Yeah.
And that's one of my favorite Stephen King adaptations as a movie because Darabont's a brilliant director. But he also decided to go so hard with the ending and it was different than the movie. And I remember hearing Stephen King say, he didn't just say he liked it. He said he liked it better than his ending. And I thought, wow, here you have this guy who's a living legend and he's alive and he's prolific and he would have every right to be totally precious with his work. And this guy came at this with no ego and a totally open mind. And I thought to myself, at least I know I can present this to him. And if he says he doesn't like it, at least it won't be because of ego. It'll be because he really doesn't think it works. It was very, very exciting when we made that change that we got his thumbs up.
And speaking of Stephen King liking it, critics and audiences really, really like this film. As of this interview, it has a 90% rating on the Rotten Tomatoes tomato meter. And you enjoyed similar approval for Strange Darling, which you directed and wrote. I'm wondering, have you been able to process this reception that you've received in the last 15 or 16 months to your movies?
It feels really good. I'm one of those filmmakers who, it's hard for me to make something with others in mind. I don't really know how to make something unless I just make something that I'd like. So sometimes that works out where other people like it, and it's the best feeling ever because you're really making a movie so people will sit in the theater and watch it. When people receive something well, it gives you more opportunities, which is always the most important thing.
Now, speaking of additional opportunities, JT, it's been announced you will adapt and direct another Stephen King book, this one, 1999's The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon. And this is through the same distributor as The Long Walk, which is Lionsgate. What drew you to this project and when would you start working on it?
It's funny you'd say that because I've got the book right next to my computer here right now. I got my notebook right next to that. And I've kind of been with Trisha in the woods for, you know, most of the summer. And I'm getting close to the end. It means a lot to me personally. I wasn't necessarily, you know, on the lookout to just do another Stephen King thing right away. But Roy Lee happened to have the rights to Tom Gordon. And my mom was an avid Stephen King reader. She still is. And this book has always been her very favorite of his. I remember when I first kind of decided to move to LA and attempt to start writing and directing movies. I remember I told my mom, I said, if I'm ever in a position to write and direct movies for studios, I'm going to make this into a movie for you.
You are still involved with the Freakling Brothers horror shows that your family began decades ago. Obviously, you're a very busy man, and that is one of the reasons why you and your family have decided to pause the Freakling Brothers horror shows for this year. I'm wondering, JT, was that a hard decision to make, given that it has been so beloved in the city for some 30-odd years and has done so well?
Very, very tough decision. Halloween for us is so much more than a business. It's how we celebrate the holiday, the month of October. And I got born into this, so I don't know any other way. I don't think I trick-or-treated maybe once, but every other Halloween was spent either scaring people or watching my dad scare people. We are very much a haunted house family, and my dad and I, you know, still design the attractions and run the company with the help of some amazing managers. The plan is not to go away. It's to come back the following year. I just got incredibly overwhelmed with film work. We could have still operated, but I just knew that we wanted to create something new because we've been promising that for a number of years. And I thought it would be more respectful to the fans to take a break and go and build that new attraction.
JT, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's our show for this Wednesday, December 31st, 2025. If you missed something, you can hear this program again tonight at 6 p.m. And if you like something you heard today, share it. You can find all of our segments at knpr.org and on most podcast apps. We'll be back here next week, or should I say next year, with more stories and conversations. I'm Paul Boger. Thank you so much for listening. Happy New Year. This is State of Nevada.